Penguin Random House Audio presents Shame on You, How to Be a Woman in the Age of Mortification. This is the author, Melissa Petro. For Molly. Prologue. The National Arts Club buzzed with restless energy. Press milled about the members-only clubhouse, journalists draining bodega coffee from paper cups as February sunlight streamed through stained glass. I hovered alone in the shadows, clutching a printout of the speech Gloria Allred and I had worked on the night before. All things considered, I looked good. The outfit, later described by the New York Post as a, quote, virginal white mohair coat, navy blue mini dress, and brown sky-high platform doomy pumps, had come from the fast fashion outlet, Zara. It probably cost $200, significant to me, as I could barely pay for shampoo at the time, let alone new clothes. Never mind what I could afford, it all felt essential, like armor. Standing at a podium that morning in the mansion turned clubhouse's former library, in front of an elaborate fireplace and surrounded by mahogany bookcases stuffed with leather-bound books, I was determined to not be what people thought of when they heard the word prostitute. I wouldn't let them make me out as a victim, sitting on a bed with my face obscured, hands folded in my lap. Nor would I be the villain the media had spent the past 6 months painting me as. People would see me, I hoped, for what I was. Your average single white female, a 30-year-old Midwesterner, one of countless transplants who'd moved to New York City for college and decided to stay. I was a writer, and until recently, I had been a public school teacher of art and creative writing at an elementary school in the South Bronx. I was also a former sex worker. And to many in the New York press corps, and it seemed to my superiors in the New York Department of Education, my past as a dancer and escort and my current role as an educator were incompatible. But was that the real issue here? Or was it maybe that I'd refused to stay silent about that past? Truth be told, I'd never been exactly secretive about it. It had never been an issue. I'd spoken freely about my prior sex work when I was in graduate school, among my friends, even to some of my teaching colleagues. But when I'd dared to get political and started raising my voice in a more public forum, the backlash had begun. It started with an op-ed I'd published on the Huffington Post months before that criticized online classifieds Craigslist founder Craig Newmark's decision to cave to political pressure and remove the erotic services section of the website. I'd used my firsthand experience selling sex on the platform to support my argument that not all the women on Craigslist were underage or working for a pimp. And because I was also arguing that sex workers should be allowed a voice in the conversation about women's participation in the sex industry and be unashamed to speak for themselves, I'd signed my name to the piece. That's when the frenzy began. After the article ran, a reporter from the New York Post put two and two together, connecting my name to another essay I'd written months earlier, in which I'd mentioned being a school teacher. The next morning, I was front page news. Bronx teacher admits, I'm an ex-hooker. The moment my employer got word of what was happening, I was banished from the classroom and hidden away in the infamous rubber room, a warehouse for teachers who were deemed too problematic to put in front of students, but not able to be fired, while my case wound its way through the city bureaucracy. All through that fall and winter, I fought hard to keep my job, but the fight was over. The press conference at the National Arts Club was my last-ditch effort to save face. When my all-star attorney, Gloria Allred, and I emerged, the room of reporters came alive like an animatronic display. For a moment, I felt as powerful a villain as they'd made me out to be. Gloria spoke first, calling the whole situation a witch hunt. "Everyone has a past," Allred said. "And people should be judged for what they do while they are employed, and not for their past sex life. Cameras and microphones pointed at Gloria, the professional, while I fixed an earnest look on my face. As she talked, I focused on looking normal, or whatever I thought normal looked like in a situation like that. I believed then, as I do now, that there is nothing morally wrong with working as a prostitute. Women have the right to do with their body what they please, and individuals who work in the sex trades deserve rights and protections. I believed in my right to speak freely about my past and share my opinions, however controversial, and I stood firm in all these convictions. But the unrelenting humiliation, the shame I felt in that moment had me doubting myself and my beliefs. When Gloria finished, I stepped over to the mic. I have decided to resign as a teacher for the New York City public school system, my speech began. It was my belief, as well as that of my attorney, that the First Amendment protected my right to publish my experiences and opinions, however controversial, and that I did not waive my rights by becoming a government employee. The Department of Education, however, disagreed. My speech went on. Regardless of the outcome of a trial, which I have every reason to believe I would have won, I do not believe I would have ever been welcomed back to the classroom by the Department of Education, and I have no interest in putting myself in places where I am not welcome. I looked up to see if anyone could tell that I was lying. The truth was that a team of pro bono lawyers had made it clear that had I brought the case to trial, I almost certainly would have lost. Before this, on day one and within the first 15 minutes of a hearing between myself and the DOE, the arbitrator told me that I was going to be fired for misconduct, which meant I wouldn't qualify for unemployment. What would I do then, he had asked, lacking the decency to conceal his smirk. I had no savings, no family, no means to support myself. 5 months after the scandal first broke, I had no job on the horizon. I was unemployed and unemployable. I was choosing to surrender my rights and resign rather than see my case to trial, in exchange for the promise that the DOE wouldn't contest my claim for unemployment insurance. Without it, I didn't know what I'd have to do to survive, and I was terrified. With those words, I quit my job in front of the entire New York City press corps. My mortification was complete. Shame is a pernicious emotion that defies definition. It's the painful distress that comes from knowing you've not lived up to an expectation, however unrealistic or impossible that expectation might be. Not only have you failed, but in shame, you hold yourself singularly responsible for that failure. At its core, shame is an existential feeling of unworthiness and profound inadequacy. It is not just the fear that others will find you unlovable. It is a deep-down fear that you don't deserve to be loved. Shame makes a person feel unique. You feel extraordinary, but it's a painful exceptionalism. In recovery, you'll sometimes hear it described as feeling like a piece of shit in the center of the universe. That's exactly how it felt the day of the press conference. Shame makes us feel as conspicuous and unwanted as a dog turd. It's the same feeling I experience a decade later when I realize I've forgotten a friend's birthday. I don't have 20 bucks to kick towards the teacher's end-of-year presents, or my kids act up in a public space. The details and severity may change, but the chilling, horrific feeling of shame is recognizable to all of us, especially women. Like most women, I've spent my lifetime at odds with this painful and largely unspoken human emotion. I've compromised female friendships, walked away from professional opportunities, skipped meals, told lies about myself, my children, and my marriage, and spent countless hours in the gym. all in a desperate attempt.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?